From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversations about healthcare in this country and the best way to get it to the most people. There are a lot of ideas, lots of talk these days among Democrats, for example, about Medicare for all, but we're going to begin with a conservative. Joseph Jarvis is a doctor and a public health consultant who's written a book about his experiences in the system and why he supports a single-payer model. We'll be right back.
KUER is growing, with new reporters set to join our newsroom this year. We want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? How can we better represent your community? What stories need to be told? Help us improve our service around Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to begin a series of conversations about health care and health insurance. And we're going to focus not on the fact that the system doesn't work all that well. Most people agree with that. It's inefficient, it's expensive, it's not accessible to millions of people. We're going to focus on the best way to deliver health care. What's the best system? You're hearing from a lot of the Democratic candidates for president these days talking about Medicare for all, and you're hearing conservatives describing it as socialism. Well, Joseph Jarvis comes down somewhere in the middle. Jarvis is a physician and a consultant in public health and environmental medicine. He's worked in public health at both the federal and state levels, and he's written a book. Really, it's a memoir about his experiences as a physician. It's also a case for a single-payer system. Basically, instead of having all these different entities paying health care costs, you have one, the government. Jarvis's book is called The Purple World, Healing the Harm in American Healthcare. And we began with the title. What does he mean by the purple world?
Well, we've politically divided ourselves into red and blue. I don't know exactly when in the history of presidential elections that became popular, but they assigned the Republican Party the red color and the Democrats the blue. And there were red states and blue states, and we were fighting over the purple states, the ones that weren't clearly going one way or the other. It's gotten worse since then, not better. People on either side of this will accuse the other side of the very things that would be true of them, too. But they're incensed only about the ones, the errors that are being made on the other side. That's making it impossible for things to happen politically. We can't compromise anymore because that's evil. So I'm searching for a world where we get back to something that I remember as a child. I grew up in the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah.
There were Democrats and Republicans, but there was a lot of room in the middle. People actually met often there. That's the space where we get big things done, like health system reform.
The time politically when you saw politicians from both sides talking to each other, when you saw the public demanding accountability from the government, what was the conversation like in those days over health care? Was there ever an ideal moment? It seems like we've been having these arguments about how to provide health care, how a system is supposed to work. Do we rely on government subsidies? Do we do single payer? It seems like these conversations we've been having for a long time. So are you, when you're thinking about that sort of more idyllic time politically, are you also hearkening back to a time when we were thinking more reasonably about health care?
Now, in part, the book intends to help people see how this developed in such a poor way. There never really has been a time when we've spoken reasonably about health care. Roosevelt was able to get a lot of his program passed. This, is, of course, predates my life, but from history, I know that he got a lot of the program passed in the 30s, but not health care.
Yeah.
Truman tried to follow up and also failed.
Yep.
Eisenhower had ideas and failed.
Why?
And the reason is because the entrenched corporate interests, the business interests, took over very early on. They saw an opportunity to make a lot of money. And boy, they've been right about that.
Yeah.
but they do not want to relinquish that territory.
I want to come back to that because this history of how we got to this point is something you write about in the book. But let me ask you about sort of your personal investment in all of this. One of the things, there are a number of stories that sort of relate this particular theme here, but you tell one particular story in the book of when you practiced clinical medicine. You were part of the faculty at the National Jewish Hospital in Denver. And you tell the story about a man from Kentucky who had traveled there suffering from black lung disease. Would you tell that story and let's talk about the lessons you got from that? Because as you say in the book, this was a moment where you kind of gave up trying.
Yes. The man was, like many of my patients at National Jewish Center, referred for a definitive diagnosis and treatment for what his local providers in Kentucky thought was black lung, and in fact it turned out to be that. We were a referral tertiary care center, the place in the United States for people with lung problems to come and get a definitive treatment and the best ideas about how to handle their problem. So he came all the way from Kentucky. He flew to Denver, and of course that means he went up in altitude, and arrived at the clinic directly from the airport, where I was to see him on an outpatient basis. That had been prearranged with his payer for his services. He was blue and struggling to breathe and not well enough for me to care for him in an outpatient setting. So I wrote the orders for him to be admitted to our hospital and asked the nurse to extricate him from the clinic and get him as fast as possible into the inpatient setting, and then I would do the workup over there. I left to do some chores and came back through the waiting room 15 minutes later, and there he was, still sitting there, blue and panting, in my waiting room.
Yeah.
And I was shocked and dismayed and not used to having my nurse not follow through with my requirements for her, and went to her and said, what's going on? And she said, I'm sorry, I can't get him into the hospital because he's only been given permission to be here for an outpatient visit. We don't have permission for inpatient services, so we're not sure we're going to be able to make that arrangement. And I was shocked. Here we were in the best place in the United States for lung problems. Here was a guy with a lung problem. We knew what to do for him. We knew everything about what needed to happen for him, and we couldn't do it because the business interests, both for the hospital and for the payer, were more important than he was. I could not believe it, and I did eventually. Within a short period of time, I left clinical practice and began doing other things.
This seemed to be a kind of a turning point for you. I mean, you talked about, as you said, you quit clinical practice. You decided to focus on public policy. Was it what you were seeing there? I mean, this wasn't the only example of this, I'm sure, where you thought, I've got to find another way in to try to fix this problem? And it was public health and public policy. Was that your way in some ways?
Well, I had been doing public health and clinical practice all along for a number of years since I'd graduated from the University of Utah School of Medicine. And I had become acquainted with the single-payer movement while I was in Denver. And so I had already started trying to advocate both at the state and the federal level for change in the form of single-payer health system reform. I just thought we need to apply more pressure. I was still a believer that the political system would somehow find a way to recognize that what we were doing was just failing us as Americans. We were way outspending everybody else, wasting hundreds of billions of dollars a year. We would certainly minds would get around this. And so, yeah, I shifted out of clinical practice, which is a very demanding kind of profession, partly because of this, partly because of family issues. So there was a combination of forces that took me there, but I clearly wanted to have time, to dedicate time to try to get this point across to the American public and through them to the politicians. We've got to change.
How do you characterize yourself, Doctor, ideologically? You're a Republican.
I was.
You were. Fancy yourself that anymore?
The day Donald Trump was officially nominated by the Republican Party to be the presidential candidate, I resigned from the party.
Huh. So where do you situate yourself ideologically then?
Well, I guess I call myself a traditional conservative.
Yeah.
Someone who harkens back to Eisenhower, Reagan. I admired him. There were a lot of things that Reagan did that I didn't agree with, but that's not the point. He did, however, speak with Tip O'Neill on a regular basis, and they found a way forward in order to make things happen. I think of him as perhaps the last real conservative who recognized you have to compromise in order to govern. So I think of myself as that kind of a conservative, not the kind that's on display today, if there is such a thing.
But the Ronald Reagan that believed in handling a situation like this through the private market, that the government doesn't have the capacity to deal with healthcare, that it borders on the idea of socialized medicine, that was Ronald Reagan. You're not along with Ronald Reagan on that score, I don't imagine.
No, I think that conservatives who, some of whom, the ones that I can admire today, still haven't quite grasped the idea that government actually has been funding healthcare in the United States from the get-go, and we need to stop pretending that the market solves all problems, specifically the problems in healthcare. When I give a public address about healthcare reform today in Utah, I always address this business sort of issue, this healthcare as a market, which it can't be. Market forces don't work in healthcare. There is nothing like the prerequisites of a market exist in healthcare. That I recognize Reagan, among many others, never got there.
Yeah.
That's, I think of as my unique calling. I need to help them understand this can't go on. We're bankrupting our country with public funding of a public good that we're pretending is a market commodity. And we're killing patients and bankrupting our families and eventually our government over this.
Give us a brief sketch, if you would, of how it is we ended up in the situation. And go back, if you would, as you do in the book, to those first health insurance plans. Because I'm interested in how it is we came up with a system where a person's employer became the main source of health care. Because it seems like this is where the problem started from your point of view.
Yes. The first health plans were first hospital plans and then physician plans were created in Texas in the 30s. Very few people actually joined in on those. These plans would give you like a stated number of days in the hospital, 21 days in a year. And for that, you would pay a fee.
Yeah.
These were always community-based fees, meaning everybody got charged the same amount. And then came World War II. After the 30s were over and we, as a nation, jumped into that, we had a need for a large production industrially for the war effort. But most of our labor force was in uniform fighting the war.
Yeah.
So we had to have the women of the country join the labor force, which they were not wont to do. They weren't used to being workers and weren't necessarily inclined to do that. And to make it further difficult, the government, in order to keep inflation at bay during the war, had capped salaries. So you couldn't, as an employer trying to produce tanks or whatever, you couldn't induce women to come in to work for you by raising wages. So what they did instead, and this was explicitly approved by the government, was they provided benefits that the employer could pay for that were tax-free,
yeah,
via a tax credit. So every dollar you would spend as an employer on a health benefit was not a dollar that you would have to spend as taxation. Everything about that act that created those economic conditions in the war was repealed after the war was over, except the employer benefit.
That's still in place.
That is still in place. I'm sure that was the health insurance industry that made sure it didn't go away.
So there's this irony here that you point out in the book. You hear from private health insurers that publicly funded health programs are socialism, but that's how they got their start, was basically this tax exemption, a government subsidy, and the system could not have existed without those subsidies, without those tax exemptions.
We couldn't have built hospitals without government funding, partly through this funding of private health insurance and partly through direct government funding of bricks and mortar. That all grew up because we suddenly had a brand new clinical enterprise that hadn't existed before the war. We could do things. In the 60s, all of the things that we now know as acute coronary intensive care were created. We couldn't have done all those without the bricks and mortar. That was directly government funding to make all of that happen. Today's value for the employer benefit is something like $300 billion a year. That's on the order of magnitude that Medicaid and Medicare are at the federal government level. We have health care in our country because we have publicly funded it. It's now, what, $3.5 trillion a year?
Yeah.
More than two-thirds of that is directly government money in the healthcare system. And a good portion of the rest of it is subsidized by the government through various tax policies.
So what you're saying is, let's give up this illusion that we don't have a system funded by the government. It seems like that would strip away a line of rhetoric that is keeping political figures from having this conversation, the idea of socialism. By the way, Doctor, I'm wondering what you're making of hearing the idea of socialism creeping up again. It seems like this is going to be a factor in the 2020 race.
Yes, they are trying to force that term on people in a negative way, as a way, they meaning the Republicans, as a way of trying to stop or forestall any real conversation about what the real problems in healthcare are. And I hope we break through it finally. That's an old, tired, ridiculous way of approaching, because nobody's actually proposing socialized medicine in the United States. I mean, really, socialized medicine is the hospitals and the doctor practices are owned and operated by the government. Everyone who's professionally in healthcare is salaried by the government. That's socialism. Yeah. That's what the Brits have. They love it, and it costs one-third per capita what our system does, and everybody there gets the care that they need. And actually with better quality than the United States. But we're not making the argument for that. Single payer is government funding for privately delivered health care, which, by the way, is what we already do. It's just that we do it in a stupid way that's entirely inefficient and actually harms patients.
You're talking about and advocating the single payer system, but it sounds like you have a bit of affection for programs like the British healthcare system. Are you just thinking that, look, we could not make that happen in the United States, therefore, let me find one that would?
No, I mean, I know the British are very fond of it.
Yeah, but you don't think it would work here, or you don't think it's necessarily the right thing for us?
I don't think it's necessary for us to do government ownership of all these private enterprises. Canada has proven that you don't have to do it. They have a single-payer system that's started province by province, which is exactly what I'm articulating here in the United States. State by state, single-payer system reform.
Joseph Jarvis, his book is called The Purple World, Healing the Harm in American Healthcare. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we begin a series of conversations about healthcare in the country and the best way to get it to the most people. There are a lot of ideas, lots of talk these days among Democrats about Medicare for All, for example, but we're beginning with a conservative. Joseph Jarvis is a doctor and a public health consultant who's written a book about his experiences in the system and why he supports a single-payer model. The book is called The Purple World, Healing the Harm in American Healthcare. Here's another detail in the book when we're talking about the history of these things, which you detail in the book, how the business model developed, and you alluded to it before. It has to do with the way health insurers started to charge premiums. You mentioned they used to have, as you said, this community rating, where they would basically charge everyone the same. But there wasn't much money to be made in that kind of a system, so they changed it to a different kind of rating. And this got us to the point where they could start to avoid insuring those who are likely to become sick, ironically. Am I getting that right?
Yes. They expanded their profits during the era from the end of the Second World War till about the time I was in medical school in the 70s. They expanded them by just increasing the number of people covered. And by the time I was in medical school, virtually all workers were covered with an employment-based benefit. So there goes their way of increasing next quarter's bottom line. They got smarter and smarter about the fact that some people use more services than others. Some people are sicker or have more accident prone or whatever. They need more services. So they began doing what's called experience rating.
Right.
They would use the person's health history against them. If they had been ill with X or if there's a member of their family that had diabetes, their expense for the premium would go up. So this would, in the employment-based system, this would cause a smaller employer some difficulty because if they had outliers among their employee base, then their premiums, which would be charged to them by the insurance company, would be unabsorbable in a larger group and therefore much higher.
Yeah.
That what that created is the downward trend in employment-based health insurance, which became the nidus for the argument about how Obamacare was necessary. We had to find a new market for people who were falling out of the employment-based market, the individual market. Experience rating then got augmented by other sneaky tricks of the insurers. For instance, they would have a place where you come to register yourself for your insurance, but it would be on the third floor of a walk-up building. So if you couldn't manage to get up to the third floor of a walk-up building, couldn't get the insurance. They just get sneakier and sneakier. And these out-of-pocket payments that people are increasingly finding not possible for them to afford are part of this game. So your premium's low. People look at the premium as a way of comparing the price. Well, but your co-insurance is high, or your co-payment is high. Or some other way they'll find your deductible will be high. And these will all have to be paid off before the insurance company ever puts a single dollar into it. This is the way they make sure that next quarter's bottom line's better than this quarter's. And they've been very good at it. But it, of course, is incredibly toxic to the patients of the United States of America.
But how do you begin? We'll get to some specifics here as we go. But how do you begin to unravel these incentives? Because you say healthcare can't work in a conventional market structure. I want to know why you think that is and how it is you think you begin to start to unravel something so entrenched in sort of it seems like the American DNA right now, this business model we're all used to at this point.
Right. Well, the direct answer to how you unravel is you don't unravel. You just directly don't permit the business model. The health insurance business model wouldn't be necessary, would be obviated by single-payer health system reform. It would be thrown on the trash heap of history where it belongs. Now, what about the market and why doesn't it work in healthcare? A market requires a buyer who is all-knowing, a buyer who knows what it is that he or she is looking for,
yeah,
and can walk away from a purchase. This is the caveat.
And be discriminating. Yeah, and
caveat emptor, yes, sort, yes, of thing. Let the buyer beware. Well, patients aren't buyers. 80% of the money in the American healthcare system is spent in urgent settings where the patient falls to the sidewalk with a heart attack and they just have to be helped. There isn't any decision making, no purchasing, no shopping. None of that is possible. Now, even in the other 20% of cases, I'd argue that patients aren't prepared to make the decisions. If you happen to have a child with an ear infection, you don't really have an option here. You can't really shop this around and say, well, this one doctor offered penicillin, but I can find a cheaper, whatever. It just doesn't work that way. You go, you get care, you get told what to do because you don't know. After all, I spent 8 years training to do the care that I provided to my patients. There's no way they can replace that. I don't care how good they can Google. It isn't going to work. All right, so you can't have the buyer.
Yep.
The sellers are supposed to be, in a market, are supposed to be completely and totally self-interested, make as much money as possible. That is what they're supposed to do.
It's their fiduciary responsibility.
They owe it to the stockholders of their company.
Yeah.
We have an oath that doctors are supposed to take who are providers or sellers of services, which says that the patient's needs come first. For obvious reasons, you can't be actually self-interested if you're caring for a patient. You're supposed to be thinking about what will help them no matter what it does to you. If it makes you get up at night, if it makes you lose money, if you don't, whatever. You've got to do the right thing for the patient in the moment.
Yeah.
So no buyers, no sellers, at least not traditional as a market. Now, there's another part of this that is a purchase that has an interest outside of the buyer-seller axis is a purchase that a market doesn't help. And every healthcare purchase is like that. I mean, it's easy to see an infectious disease. You've got somebody walking around with active tuberculosis in the community. Everyone else is at risk. It's in all of our interest that that person gets the right care in the right setting until they're no longer an infectious risk. But even in the case of trauma, where, of course, the care that a trauma patient gets doesn't really directly affect me, it does if I'm going to be the next trauma patient. That's why we call it the practice of medicine. We need to do it right so that the practitioners stay sharp, so they do the best work they possibly can each and every case. Organizing healthcare is not a competitive business. It is, in fact, something that we cooperate to do best. This has been long recognized, why we have regional trauma centers, regional perinatal care centers. We do this, regional coronary care centers.
Yeah.
We do this better when we do it in numbers and when the doctors and nurses are practiced because they do it over and over again. These are cooperative endeavors. And finally, all of the things that we're used to thinking, you know, it's just ingrained in us about markets don't work in healthcare. And the one example I like to use is price. Price is supposed to be related to demand. You set the price high, there will be fewer people demanding whatever that is. A high
but the
price,
demand doesn't go down in medical care, I'm guessing.
So we'll use insulin as an example. It's a great example. Insulin cost or price has gone up, what, 4,000% in less than a decade? The demand for it hasn't gone down at all.
Yeah.
Why? Because demand in healthcare is determined by epidemiology. How many cases of diabetes are there? That's the demand for insulin. Now, they'll bankrupt themselves buying insulin because the alternative is to die. It doesn't work like that. It's likewise the case. You drop a price, you don't increase the demand. I've never seen an appendectomy happen because it was on sale this week. Nobody does that.
Yeah.
Nobody. It's ludicrous to talk about this as market forces. It doesn't work that way. It never will work that way.
So let's talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And you're pretty candid in your assessment. Here's what you write in your book. Everything wrong about American healthcare was made worse by Obamacare.
Yes, that's exactly how I feel about it. It was a mistake from the get-go on every level, politically, functionally, economically. It just was a wrong-headed way to approach it.
Why? But just essentially why?
Because the real problem in American healthcare is cost. And it made the cost worse.
Yeah.
We have high costs because we waste. We have high waste because we have poor quality care. That's called quality waste. When you don't care for a patient correctly the first time, you're going to cost yourself money in the long run. That's poor quality care. We have 400,000 people die every year in the United States because they were injured as a hospitalized patient. There was a preventable event that caused them injury that led to their death. How many deaths do we have from the leading causes of death in the United States? Well, it's 600,000 for heart disease and about the same number for cancer. So this makes preventable patient injury in the hospital the third leading cause of death in our country. That's poor quality care. There's no excuse for that. It happens to be the case because we're distracted by the profit motive. You can have either the most profitable care or you can have the best quality care, but you can't have both.
You write about how facts matter, but values matter too. You write, I love the values of biblical living, but also the facts of public health science, which some people would say they don't always go together necessarily so well, but you see them as absolutely dovetailing. How do you use both of those to fashion a healthcare system? Because it's essentially what you're trying to do.
Well, the prophets of the Old Testament who are valued by Christians and Jewish and even Muslim believers all alike, these prophets harped continuously on the inability of evil or sinful society to care for its sick and injured. They made it clear that the reason why Jewish society was disrupted by invasion and Jehovah didn't protect them was because they failed to take care of the people who needed care. That was a theme that was reiterated by Jesus Christ himself when he was on this earth. In fact, the last thing he said, at least according to the Matthew in the New Testament, was the sheep and the goats. You know, he was going to separate people, nations is what he said, into those who had followed his principles, who had visited the least of these, and he included in that the sick, and those who had not. And that was reiterated for the LDS audience in the Book of Mormon. Those prophets likewise endorsed that. This is why I consider myself a conservative in the sense of these old, ancient, long-held values. We need to care for each other. There is no way to have a society that succeeds if we don't do that. We'll fall apart. And I think, in fact, there's evidence that we indeed are, because we aren't caring for each other right now in the United States.
I want to ask you about something that you said which seemed startling to me. You said, if we can't figure this out, we'll cease to be the greatest country in the world. Do you think that's if we don't figure something? Do you mean specifically healthcare? Do you mean specifically the care for those who are in need? Just expand on that a little bit more, because this stuck out to me.
Yes, I mean healthcare. If we don't figure out health system reform in a way that cares for people, we will cease to be a leading nation. And that's not my thought. That's Mike Leavitt's thought. Former Secretary of Health and Human Services, former governor of Utah, he said there is no place on the international leaderboard for a nation that spends 25% of its GDP, gross domestic product, on health care. We're the only nation who has any concern about that. We're at almost 20% of gross domestic product spent on health care as we sit here today. And we're the ones that have a rising percentage of the gross domestic product, rapidly rising percentage. This is the growth in the cost curve that people keep talking about bending when they talk about health system reform. Obamacare actually bent it in the wrong direction. It increased the rate of how fast our costs are going up. We either stop that from happening, or we'll end up spending ourselves in healthcare out of being a world leader in everything else. We aren't a world leader in healthcare. We're just a world leader in how much it costs, because we're the ones that waste the most.
There are a lot of great stories in here, and a lot of provocative connections that you make. One is there the similarities between prostitution, which is legal there in some places there, and health insurance. This is something you write. You said, like prostitution, the business interests of American health insurance are in direct conflict with the health interest of those who purchase the service. Expand on that a little bit more, because this was a revelation that came to you as you were in Nevada.
But the first time I read about HIV surveillance of Nevada brothels was before I actually moved to Nevada and assumed the role of state health officer. This was right in the crux of the HIV epidemic and the high level of concern and anxiety that Americans everywhere had about HIV and AIDS. The brothel industry realized that it had a crisis on its hands. Yeah. If people put two and two together and realized that having promiscuous sex at a brothel represented a risk for acquiring HIV infection, they would stop frequenting the brothel. So their business interest was in trying to figure out a way to persuade people that it was safe. So they came up with a system of testing for HIV every single prostitute each month throughout the state of Nevada. And then they would publish the results. Okay, that was in the late 1980s, and they, not surprisingly, found no HIV infection in the brothel prostitutes that month. Well, it's now been how many years since? 30-some-odd years since? Month after month after month, they've produced the same statistics. There's never been a case of HIV infection in a brothel prostitute in Nevada in all those years. Now, what I would argue is anyone who thinks for just 2 seconds about that knows that that's not possible. That simply didn't happen. And to add weight to that, I actually surreptitiously did a survey of hepatitis B infection rates in that same group of people using the HIV samples that had been sent into the state laboratory. They had a very high rate of hepatitis B infection relative to comparing to the rest of the population in the United States. I think it was 15%. They were infectious, okay? Hepatitis B and HIV are acquired in exactly the same ways. Body fluid transmissions, right?
Yep.
These people are the people who are at risk for HIV. I'm not looking down my nose at them. They do what they do, and I wasn't trying to change that. But I am wondering how it is that the people in Nevada have, for year after year, simply looked the other way and said, oh, okay, everything's safe, everything's fine in the Nevada brothels because nobody ever gets HIV there. No, that's not true. I know that's not true. Well, in the same way, we look the other way when we talk about health insurance. It's a business model that, by its nature, harms people. They do what they did to my black lung case in Denver. They deny them a service that they need, or they make it so expensive they can't afford it, or they bankrupt themselves, or worse. Those are the things that are everyday experience for American families all across our nation and nowhere else in the first world. Because we're the ones that take this business model and allow them to tell us this is coverage is what we need. It's nonsense. It's a lie. It's just like pretending that there never was an HIV infection in a brothel. It's PR. This is what they do to try to persuade us to continue to use their business model. That's what I meant by the analogy.
There's another analogy you make from an experience that you had in Nevada. This one was with, I think, in Elko, in a Nevada nursing home there. And you write about how it illustrates, as you put it, how constitutional federalism can work in the U.S. healthcare system.
The case was a nursing home that we did a routine investigation, or routine inspection, I should say, and they discovered that every single person on the staff of the nursing home had converted their tuberculin test, that is the TB skin test, from negative to positive during the interval since the last inspection. Now, that's a remarkable event. Some exposure had occurred, and you have to presume it's in the nursing home. The team called me and said, what do we do about this? I said, find the case. There's an active case of tuberculosis somewhere in the nursing home. Now, turned out to be kind of the head person over nutrition services. She had TB when she was young. It had been treated. She had done well for many years, but she developed arthritis, and her doctor had treated her with steroids, which reduces her body's ability to fight off TB. And her case of tuberculosis had recurred. She was coughing up tubercle bacilli all over the nursing home. So I said, well, she has to be treated. She needs to be taken where she can be treated and not be at the nursing home until she's healthy again and no longer an infectious risk. And there is a protocol in the United States for treating recently converted skin tests. So all of the staff had to go on that protocol. And then you had to go look around among all the patients and find all those people who had converted their skin tests and treat them as well. So there was going to be a significant amount of expense and work. And the nursing home simply refused to do it. They just flat said no. And I didn't have a hammer to hit them with. They didn't care whether they passed their inspection, obviously. That's the only thing I could do. So we went to the State Board of Health and asked the State Board of Health for emergency regulations that would allow us to hammer them on their license until they did the right thing. And the State Board of Health refused to pass the regulations because, of course, of the lobby of the nursing home industry in the state. They didn't want anybody affecting their ability to make money. I was totally frustrated. I didn't know what else I could do. What happened next was a surprise to me. The regional director of Health and Human Services for the federal government, who sits in San Francisco, called me up and said, is it true? Is there a nursing home in Nevada that's not complying with tuberculosis infection issues? And I said, that's true. It's in Elko, and we're at an impasse with them. He said, well, I'm not paying another bill. Of course, he had the federal half of Medicaid, and most nursing homes' patients are there being paid for by Medicaid. It's the biggest source of income for nursing homes. You can't believe it. The next day, I got a call from the nursing home administrator. What can we do to fix this? We fixed it up, and they got paid, you know, down the road a ways. And I thought, wow, this is great. I did the best I could. You know, of course, states are where the primacy for health policy ought to be, according to the Constitution. But, you know, the federal government backing you up and doing the right thing, this is perfect. Good cop, bad cop. It works every time, right?
So apply that to the way you see a system working now. What's the connection that you're making there? Just the role of the federal government in seeing these through?
The federal government is the lion's share payer for health services in the country.
Yeah.
But let's not exclude how important the states are in terms of policy and on-the-ground expertise. $700 billion a year in our health system originates from state and local taxes. Let's not ignore that. And where do we have the expertise about delivery of services in a given region? We have it at the state level. Why? Because, well, Utah has a different kind of population than is true of other states. Utah happens to be blessed with the lowest per capita health care costs in the country. Massachusetts has the highest. They have an entirely different health care system than we do.
What's the difference?
Well, they have multiple tertiary care centers that service not just Massachusetts residents, but in New England and further. Boston is a place where there, what? Is there a half a dozen medical schools? We have one. We have one set of tertiary places to come in Salt Lake City. They have a very small geographic area to cover. There are no rural areas, at least not as we understand them in the West, in Massachusetts. We have vast areas where it's very difficult to maintain a hospital because the costs are so high. You can't keep surgeons out there. And yet if you need trauma care after you've fallen and injured yourself in one of our beautiful five national parks, you got to have a surgeon out there somewhere to help with that care and deliver it.
So people have to get together. They have to collaborate. There can't be isolation like there are. That's one of the keys here.
And the collaboration is going to be different here in Utah than in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Let us use the local expertise and have a state be the basis for health policy, but recognize that the federal government represents a major funder. And so let them make a minimum standard that they require for the funding. Federal, they're the backstop. They create the funding because I don't want to change anything. We don't need to. We have plenty of money in the system. Let's just use it wisely.
So let's get down to some of the particulars of your idea. You propose creating this new government agency. Now, this particular Utah Health System Commission that you have in mind, is it unique to Utah, or is there a similar template used in states throughout the country? Are you just thinking Utah right now?
I'm just thinking Utah right now, yeah. Although it certainly could be replicated elsewhere. It doesn't have to be this way either. I've proposed a payer that's a nonprofit private trust fund. It's actually based on the model that already exists for public employees, the Public Employees Health Plan in Utah,
right,
which has the lowest overhead among all payers.
You like that system. You like that model.
What's not to like? 4% overhead compared to the average of 15% for everyone else. It's perfect. It works for 200,000 to 300,000 Utahns right now. We don't have to build something new. We don't have to create anything new. It's already there. That's the pair. We rename it from Utah Public Employees Health Plan to the Utah Health Cooperative. That's what I've called it.
Right.
And then there's a new agency that's created, the Utah Health Systems Commission,
yep,
which has the job of creating the health benefit based on the best science, the best clinical science available. What actually works? They're not supposed to pay for just anything. They're supposed to pay for the cheapest alternative that is actually effective. I use as an example, eyeglasses are cheaper than LASIK surgery. You get your corrective lenses, and you're good to go for a lot less than if you had to have LASIK. Not that LASIK wouldn't be available, but you would buy that out of your own pocket if you wanted to, because you could go shop for that if you felt like that's the way you wanted to handle it. So health system commissions would use all of the expertise of Utah doctors, and they would have to keep it updated. Things change. What works today is not necessarily what's going to work next year.
Two principal tasks for this commission. A, define the clinically proven set of health benefits for every citizen in Utah. Mentioned that. And B, efficiently adjudicate claims against any part of the health system. How does that work?
It works like workers' compensation adjudication does today. If you get injured or ill or made ill at work, you can file a workers' compensation claim. And not surprisingly, there can be conflicts. And so there has to be adjudication. Did this injury actually cause the current condition that the claimant has, et cetera? So somebody who goes to the hospital and they file a claim saying I was injured at the hospital, or I should have had this paid for but it wasn't paid for, those are the kinds of claims I'm thinking about. And there will be, like there is in the workers' compensation system, an administrative law judge who will handle all that. No jury trials, no punitive damages. Things will be handled expeditiously or relatively so and for far less expense. This is to address the issue that malpractice is a big driver in the cost of American healthcare. It's debatable about whether that's really true and exactly how much of a problem it is. But it is true that defensive medicine, by definition, is not the kind of medicine we want practiced. It's medicine for the defense of the doctor. And we actually want medicine for the patient, not to defend a doctor from a claim.
You talked about this transformation you make from the public employees health plan. You're now wanting to call it the Utah Health Cooperative. This is the idea. And you talk about it going through this transformation over the course of a couple of years. How does that work?
Well, I propose that as soon as the bill is passed, either through a ballot initiative or at the legislature, that the bill include in it wording that says upon signature of the governor, the Utah Public Employees Health Plan immediately starts selling policies to anybody who wants to buy one. That way, immediately, there's already buy-in that starts happening. Now, that's in part because I recognize that if it passes as a ballot initiative, the legislature might do to it what they did to Ballot Initiative 3 in this last session.
Yeah.
So that's the first step. And as that's already occurring, while people are already beginning to buy in, the Utah Health Commission starts its process and produces an actual description of what the health benefit will be. And then the Utah Health Cooperative can refashion itself around that new benefit. And at the end of 2 years, however it's defined by the legislature, that is citizenship or residence in Utah, whatever way they want to do it, and I'm not trying to make a point about that, that is exactly what I intend. Whatever the legislature wants to say, how inclusive it is, that's who will immediately be issued a card that says, I'm a member of the Utah Health Cooperative, and that's what they'll use to pay from then on for their health services.
Before any of that can happen, you acknowledge that what you're going to have to have first is the passage of what you call a state-based Universal Health Care Act. This is the part that's going to need Congress to sort of sign off on.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about that particular part, because this seems pretty daunting.
This is daunting.
Isn't an acknowledgement, finally. I mean, this gets at what we were saying before. There are constant partisan conflicts, how anyone's going to come to an agreement on a basic Universal Health Care Act at this point. I'm not sure what you're imagining how that would even happen.
Yeah, good question. The Medicare for All people are running into this very buzzsaw right now. There doesn't seem to be any way forward. They can elect all the progressives they want from the blue states. The red states are in number and great enough that they'll never make it. They'll never allow it to happen. So federal legislation is required for us to go somewhere about this. Why do I think federal legislation for state-based universal health care will work? Well, because I heard Mike Lee said he would support it. When I was in the audience during his very first debate as a first-time candidate in 2010 for the Senate, and I asked the question, would you pass legislation that would allow the state of Vermont to do single-payer health system reform? And he said, much as I am opposed to single-payer health system reform, I would support that legislation because I think states ought to be able to do what they want to do. I think we can find a core of people like Mike Lee in Congress who will cross over, not all of them, not even the majority of them, but enough of them to join with the people on the other side of the aisle to pass this legislation. And I don't think that's going to be true of Medicare for All. Mike Lee would never vote for Medicare for All. There isn't. I can't think of a single Republican who would ever.
But they're so inclined to give states their own say, states' rights, that you see a way forward.
They would certainly do this. I mean, other than hearing Mike Lee say it, have I canvassed? No. I would love to, and maybe eventually I'll get around to actually trying to make that happen. But I think that is the way forward. It's one of the arguments I make for state-based single payer. It's that it's politically expedient to do it this way.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. One of the things you mentioned in your book is that you have a message for the red states and you have a message for the blue states. The message for the red states you sort of mentioned before, that it comes from the Bible, caring for the sick, caring for the poor. What's the message you have for the blue states? Because this is where you get to the poet John Donne, which I kind of wanted you to talk about.
Well, the poet John Donne, that refers to Meditation 17, No Man is an Island. His father-in-law was a physician, in fact, quite famous and well-known in the era. And he used to tell his medical students that were training with him, before you meddle with a patient, negotiate your fee while they are yet in pain.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is modern American medical business parlance said in Elizabethan English. And I contrasted that with John Donne's message about no man is an island, which occurs. Meditation 17 is something that happens while he's dean of St. Paul's. He's ill himself at the end of his life. The bells are tolling for a funeral, and he wonders out loud, is that my funeral that this is for? And then says, you know, when the bells toll, it doesn't matter whether it's mine or someone else's. It matters to all of us. It always matters. Those do not ask for whom the bells toll. They toll for you. And then make the point, bells are tolling in the United States. We're just ignoring them. And that's true of the left side of the aisle, because they're also market-based reformers. That's what Obamacare is all about. That's as true for them as it is for the right side of the aisle. They both need to hear the same message. Let's get past this. Let's start bickering about Obamacare and let's do the real business.
Joseph Jarvis, his book is The Purple World, Healing the Harm in American Healthcare. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.